I'm Nancy Donahue, and this is Talk at the Top. Talk at the Top is your ticket to conversations with key influencers who are shaping biopharma and healthcare today. So welcome to Talk at the Top. Today's guest is Roger Longman, CEO of Real Endpoints. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Today's topic is something that's been very, very prolific in terms of the media, political rhetoric right now, and it's been going on for the last couple of years, which is pharmaceutical pricing. So Real Endpoints is an analytics company that serves both payers and drug makers to help them better define true value of pharmaceuticals through clinical trial data and other data that you put together for them. So, Roger, just curious, what made you decide to start this company now after, of course, many years running Wendover Information and then selling that to Elsevier? What sort of prompted you to start this company?
I suppose two things, Nancy. One is that my investors in Wendover, in particular my chairman, Norman Selby, wanted to do this again. They've done well the first time. And the second issue was that we felt that no one was adequately addressing what we thought was going to be the single biggest issue in pharmaceuticals, which was, how do you pay for this stuff? And thus we began scoping out a new company to try to come up with solutions to the reimbursement challenges.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you. I'd like to learn a little bit more about that in a moment. But in terms of the topic at hand, with the rapid rise of specialty drug costs, especially over the last few years, it seems like the media is really vilifying the drug companies for these exponential, both the hikes of currently marketed drugs that seem to be sort of, you know, it seems like there's no transparency to the why or what's the purpose behind the drug price hikes, as well as some of the new innovative drugs coming out, particularly biopharmaceuticals, that are just so extremely expensive. We've never seen, you know, drugs at these prices, like close to $300,000 a year, for example, for a cystic fibrosis drug. But do you think it's fair to point the finger at the manufacturers for this whole mess that we're in right now with unsustainable drug costs?
Nancy, there's blame that can be spread around to many, many different parties, and the pharmaceutical companies certainly come in for their share. So is it fair? No, largely because there are lots of other guys who make money on high-priced drugs. But yes, it is true that the pharmaceutical industry has taken advantage of their ability to price drugs high, and frankly, their ability to do so without a lot of transparent validation of the value that they're providing. But remember, they work within a distribution and reimbursement system, including the providers, who make money on drugs, and that the greater the volume and the higher the prices, there are lots of people who make money. Physicians, oncologists in particular, make more money the higher the price of the drugs. PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, make more money the higher the price and the greater the volume. Distributors of various stripes, not merely PBMs, but groups like Walgreens, McKesson, all of these people take a percentage of the price and therefore have incentives to keep this game going. Where the problem or the challenge, this reimbursement system changes, or when the people who are ultimately putting their hands in their pocket and taking money out for drugs begin to become more aggressive about handling these costs.
Yeah, and I think you're right about there's a lot of different players along the supply chain that are making a percentage, and I don't think that's very visible or understood by a lot of consumers, frankly. But it does appear that there's many pharmaceutical companies that are just not reading the tea leaves about the sort of climate that we're in. I think the best latest example being Mylan with the EpiPen, raising the price of this life-saving drug for asthma, you know, twice in the same year seems sort of hard to figure out. So in your opinion, what should biopharma companies and pharma companies be doing differently today that they're not doing?
Yeah, boy, it's a great question, Nancy. I think there are a number of things that they should be doing differently. And part of this gets to the kind of people who are running drug companies right now and why I think you, frankly, Nancy, can be helpful going forward. One of the issues is that I think that the pharmaceutical industry is structurally challenged given just how long it takes to develop a drug. So you start with a drug and 10 years later you find out whether it's working or not. Well, that means that you put in a significant investment long before you actually know whether the drug is going to be cost effective to the system. And it forces managers at drug companies to sort of think about their drugs as necessarily cost effective, whether they are or not. I mean, they've got this big sunk cost. They've projected to their investors and their bosses certain kinds of market projections. How are they going to back off of those now? It's a difficult problem. The second thing is that most pharmaceutical commercial executives still believe that deep down that physicians are making the entire prescribing decision. And that's no longer true.
Right.
Certainly a physician has to prescribe a drug.
Mm-hmm.
But the choice of which drugs to prescribe has in fact become significantly more circumscribed.
Mm-hmm.
And the groups that are limiting that choice are payers of various stripes, PBMs, insurance companies, sometimes the government. And understanding the kind of power this new customer, let's call it managed markets or payers, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term at the moment, understanding their power and how they make decisions becomes maybe the most important capability in any pharmaceuticals company's commercial management. It's not clear to me that most pharmaceutical companies either believe what I'm saying or have the kinds of people, even if they do, have the kinds of people who understand those customers and know how to deal with them.
Yes, it does seem like they're still kind of stuck in the paradigm of, okay, we're going to, you know, launch a drug and put out enough pharmaceutical reps to cover and educate all the doctors, and we'll have our payer access folks. But you're right, it doesn't seem like they've really changed the model much, just from where I sit. So then on the other side, as you mentioned, the PBMs and payers, they appear to be getting more and more conservative every year with regard to, you know, pre-authorization requirements and coverage policies. And I think it's leaving physicians in particular more frustrated than ever when they really do feel like they have a patient who is a good candidate, even for a very expensive drug. They're having to jump a lot of hoops to get that approved. So what do you think that the payer side could be doing differently and better to improve, again, this quandary that we're in?
Well, I think, Nancy, first of all, I would not say that payers and PBMs are getting more conservative. My term is, frankly, I think they're getting more activist.
Okay.
In terms of their willingness to restrict formularies, the kinds of restrictions they're imposing, the kinds of levels of prior authorization that they are imposing. And they are becoming more activist. But understand, too, that they are doing what they're doing in order to build the businesses that they've got today. And PBMs make money on rebates. It's therefore in their best interest to try to figure out how to most effectively bargain with drug companies to ensure that they get the most significant rebates they can. To some extent, the insurance companies are in the same position. The fastest growing part of the insurance business now is the ASO side, which administrative services only, which means the insurance company is not actually at risk for the cost of care. Certainly they are incentivized to keep costs under control, but they're not at risk. And that means that they can also make money on the drug side through rebates and not have to worry. At least their profitability isn't specifically tied to reduction in drug costs. And in terms of, which means that they too can make money on rebates, which means that they too can impose exclusions and other kinds of restrictions to maximize their financial benefit. Now, it's not to say that they're not also thinking carefully about what their customers' best interests are. They certainly are doing so, or the customers will find other payers who do a better job of that. But it's not particularly easy for me to see that the payers and PBMs are always so completely on the side of their customers, the employers or to some extent the government. I think that the more important changes are going to come as the reimbursement structure changes. And in particular, I think that this will happen, more financial responsibility gets shifted onto the shoulders of the providers. As the providers become at risk for cost, and depending on how that all works out, then those providers are going to start making different kinds of choices. So, for example, if more and more providers are going to be paid on a capitated basis, that is to say, I'm going to be paid a certain amount for keeping this patient healthy and out of the hospital for a period of time, the more those providers are going to start making different kinds of decisions over the entire episode of care, but specifically related to drugs. It may be that a provider will say, what I really need is to use this far more expensive drug, which reduces the chances that this patient will come in to see me again quickly or will be in the hospital or will have other side effects or exacerbations that need to be dealt with. That is, the most cost-effective way for me to work is to use a more expensive drug. On the other hand, it could be that these providers will say, wait a minute, I actually can do this more effectively with a much cheaper drug, and that's the one I'm going to use because my incentive is the overall cost of care. It's once responsibility devolves onto the people who are providing care, and depending on how you define that responsibility, then reimbursement is going to change significantly. And I think we're moving in that direction. I don't think we cannot move in that direction. We do, however, have this gigantic infrastructure of PBMs and distributors and insurance companies whose interests are not aligned with, in general, with a capitated cost system.
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting what you're talking about. For example, I'm thinking of one of my clients, which is Nationwide Children's. They have a large ACO. They're fully capitated at risk for 330,000 children across Central Ohio. So I guess it brings me to, you know, my next question is, given this increasing complexity and unpredictability, drug pricings and what's the uptake's going to be and access and all that, what kind of talent do you think is needed now in both pharma companies as well as I'm thinking of some of my clients like ACOs where they are taking risk to be able to, you know, deal with this sort of complexity?
Well, I think with pharma, I think we've talked about this a little bit. I think we do need people in the pharmaceutical industry who really understand the payer side far better than I think senior management at most pharmaceutical companies do today. On the payer side, I guess I have been impressed that so few are willing to try to experiment in serious ways with different models of payment. That's, I suppose, understandable. They're making a lot of money doing what they do now. But in terms of talent, there are few folks who have, or there are not many folks, who have really tried to build new kinds of businesses around the reimbursement space with new models. Certainly, I guess where this really hits home is on the provider side. You've got a client which is doing the ACO thing, which is great, but most of the providers, certainly that I've dealt with, do not really have the kind of actuarial talent to run a kind of insurance business. They certainly, this is a business of judging risk. And I'm not sure that they've got the people who have done that before in any significant way to allow them to be successful, which is why so many ACOs have not worked out. There are a few that have, but it's challenging. Meanwhile, most hospitals are kind of caught up in this problem, not of their own making, and a problem with which I have great sympathy, in that they have, on the one hand, a business in which they make money by filling beds. And on the other hand, they have lines of business in which they lose money by keeping their beds full. But they have this giant infrastructure to support. There are very few providers that I know which are willing to go all in on an outcomes-based system when they've got so much at risk by doing so. That means, you know, oh, I've got all of these empty beds. That's great for one part of my business, but it ain't great for another. that's a challenge that very few companies have the skills, informational skills, management skills, actuarial skills, to really manage.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's going to take a long time for them to adjust to this new sort of world that we live in. It's more value-based care, because it is a little schizophrenic. They have one foot on the shore and one foot on the boat, so to speak, in terms of the inpatient revenue versus, okay, I'm supposed to be doing ambulatory care and, you know, prevention and wellness. And I agree. I think it's a little bit schizophrenic right now.
I can actually give you an interesting example.
Oh, do you? Oh, yeah, I'd love that.
Which is in the anti-infective world. I mean, we know that, and it's a complex problem, and there are no easy solutions. But you know, there are now some drugs out, which anti-infective drugs, which can keep patients out of hospitals. Those patients with severe, for example, skin soft tissue infection. The standard drug, which is generic, requires a patient to be hospitalized. That's a good thing for those hospitals who are making money by filling beds, for whom that patient is moneymaker. It's not a good thing for those hospitals in which the patient is, say, a Medicare patient under a DRG. So here are some now new drugs which come out which get that patient out even after a day or even as an outpatient. Well, does the hospital embrace this drug? Not necessarily, because for the hospital, he's looking, he said, well, wait a minute, I'm actually going to lose money on this patient at this point. And therefore, because he's not going to be in the hospital, and therefore, maybe I shouldn't use this drug, which will, of course, reduce costs overall for the system. But the hospital doesn't really care about the system. The hospital cares about its own economics. This is not simply an economic decision. There may be physicians at the hospital, infectious disease physicians, which might say, you know what? These patients with these kinds of infections, I can't rely on them to take their pills. I want to make sure I observe them doing so. The easiest way for me to do that is to keep them in the hospital so that if they don't take their pills when they're on the outside, we don't see resistance problems developing. Okay, I get that. It's a good medical reason. Maybe there are ways that one can manage that issue in some alternative fashion. But if you think about that, the medical side, plus the hospital economic side, you can see how frustrating it is for a drug company who comes up with a drug which is clearly cost-saving, or could be clearly cost-saving, when they run into this sort of problem. That is, I think, a big problem.
Yeah, you're right. It's really kind of the behavioral part of this is getting the hospital to change its ways and take a risk. Well, speaking of kind of new models and changes, what about some of the outcome-based reimbursement for drugs? You know, this is obviously a new trend. Do you think we're going to be seeing more and more of that?
I do think so, Nancy. I think we will. The challenge so far is that it has not been widely embraced because of the complexities of doing outcomes-based reimbursement. First, it's not clear that the outcomes that can be easily measured are the outcomes which are valuable. So right now, we've got an interesting issue. You've heard of these so-called PCSK9 inhibitors.
Right, the lipid-lowering, very aggressive lipid-lowering drugs.
Right, they're very expensive, but they also just dramatically lower LDL cholesterol. That's great. What they haven't proven is that the reduction in LDL cholesterol reduces cardiovascular events and cardiovascular deaths. Well, I think they will prove that, and there's an outcomes trial from Amgen that is the top line of which is going to read out the end of this year. I assume they'll be able to release the top line data at the end of this year. But in the meantime, this drug is out. These drugs are out. So the question is, how do we judge outcomes? Well, the most obvious way is to say, let's measure LDL cholesterol. Okay, fine, let's do that. And let's pay only if the LDL cholesterol has gone down. But if what we really want to measure is outcomes, and we don't know what those outcomes are, it's sort of difficult to do an outcomes-based deal that's truly helpful for the payer or provider. What's the real metric that we're using? And once you start getting into those kinds of metrics, for example, outcomes metrics, it may not be so easy for the payer or the provider to actually gather the data together. It's not automatic. Many of these drugs, for example, would be going through PBM channels, Well, the PBMs don't necessarily have all of that medical data on which you can make judgments about whether the drug is working or not. Certainly, we can use proxy criteria. Did the patient refill his prescription? That would be an indication that it's working. But those are proxies. They're not as reliable as knowing that the drug actually did what it was supposed to do. So there's lots of challenges to outcomes-based reimbursement. On the other hand, it is such a good idea. It is such an obvious idea that people will figure out solutions to these problems, all of which can be solved. There's nothing that is structurally impossible to do here. And it is clear that we're going to need to do it. Now, what that might mean, incidentally, for the pharmaceutical industry is a different kind of business model. It may be that the idea is no longer that you make money selling drugs, but maybe you make money via kind of a subscription. I keep LDL, you know, you subscribe to my LDL lowering service, and as long as I keep that LDL down, you pay me. Now, that's not necessarily, that's, you know, you're not paying the company on a per pill basis. You're paying them for ultimately delivering an outcome you want. And as long as that outcome is reached, you keep paying.
Yeah, that seems like that would work, make sense for kind of chronic diseases like that. Maybe also diabetes, for example, where there's a lot of things you need to be measuring in a very disciplined and methodical way over time.
Right.
Huh, interesting. So are we going to see more of that in the oncology space too? Because I would think that's an area where there's got to be some natural outcomes that you can measure, because those folks are going to the doctor a lot, right? And there's either the tumor shrinks or it doesn't. Either you increase their length of life or you don't. I mean, is that an area where we're going to see some of this?
Yes, I think so. The issue isn't so much, well, first of all, there are a number of cancers which are probably going to become chronic diseases as opposed to shorter or longer term acute conditions. You can think about, for example, multiple myeloma, where patients are living longer and longer and longer, and the drugs are used over much longer periods of time. Clearly, that increases the expense of drug therapy, but it also allows for these kinds of outcomes-based deals based on, you know, is the drug keeping these people alive and functional? So I think that's going to happen, certainly in oncology. But the other big, I think, innovation in terms of oncology pricing or value-based pricing in oncology, I think will be in indication-specific pricing, where you have one drug that is used in multiple indications. And I don't mean to limit this to oncology, but oncology is a good example. So right now we have a number of these immuno-oncology drugs, PD-1s and PD-L1s, have been approved or close to approval. And they are going to be used in multiple indications. Well, the question is, do you pay the same price for their use in each of these indications? And the answer, I think, Nancy, is that we will probably be moving to indication-specific pricing.
I see.
Which means you're going to need to have some kind of evaluation system, some kind of way of defining the value of the drug in, say, non-small cell lung cancer versus the value of the drug in, say, a malignant melanoma. Mm-hmm. If the drug works in one really well and in the other not so well, maybe there are going to be different prices. And I think that kind of system is one more aspect of what you're talking about, which isn't just outcomes-based reimbursement, it's really value-based reimbursement. It's mm-hmm. saying how valuable, what benefits does this drug confer on the patient, and can we price relative to that benefit?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. One other question, too, regarding earlier we talked about sort of the misalignment of goals that we think is very obvious today in healthcare. And I noticed that hospitals and health systems are moving more and more toward the population health approach, as we talked about, value-based care, whereas drug companies over the last few years have all been running to the whole rare diseases space and niche drugs and specialty drugs that treat relatively really, really small populations and rare diseases. So how did we get here? You know, was that kind of unintended consequence of rules and regs or the ACA, or what is your thoughts on that?
One, I'm not sure that the population health trend that you're talking about really has much to do with the increasing emphasis in pharmaceutical companies on highly specialized diseases. That trend, the trend towards specialization, really comes from a number of different issues. One is that it's very difficult to get a drug that's marketed to a broad population, diabetics, hypertensives, people with high cholesterol, onto the market. There's just huge safety burdens that have to be proved. It's expensive. Meanwhile, what the drug industry has discovered, largely thanks to oncology, but other areas as well, is that specialty drugs can be more cost-effective to develop and more cost-effective to market. Fewer sales reps, lower commercialization, smaller commercialization infrastructures, but that they can price them at levels that can give them really dramatic returns. Thus, a specialty drug like Humira can become the biggest drug in the world. I'm assuming the price, you know, sort of at the $40,000 level, whereas, you know, the normal primary care product might be somewhere in the $2,000 to $4,000 range. That paradigm, that movement from many, many sales reps, large commercial infrastructures, to fewer sales reps, smaller commercial infrastructures, higher prices, has just made all sorts of sense for the drug industry. Of course, that depends on the willingness of the system to pay those high prices. And increasingly, I think, the fact that so many companies have piled into these specialty areas increases the chance for competition and price competition. No better example exists than what's happened in the hepatitis C market,
right,
where
Gilead.
Gilead came in, priced its drug at, you know, $80,000 to $90,000, and then when AbbVie arrived, that pricing started to really crater once Express Scripts, the PBM, decided to go with the AbbVie drug, to prefer the AbbVie drug, and to exclude from most patients the Gilead drugs. Suddenly the price began to really crater. You can also see that when Merck came in with its drug, the price fell further. So it's the notion, this combined notion of competition and the willingness of payers to bargain really hard and to exclude drugs, even in specialty categories, kind of limits the long-term viability of specialist strategies, unless, of course, the drugs are so completely unique, you referred to cystic fibrosis, that they can maintain these prices because there's no competition. That's what's happened with Vertex, why it can charge for Kalydeco the kinds of prices it's charging.
Well, then, in starting to wrap up here, I was just curious, tell us a little bit about some of the solutions that Real Endpoints provides to your clients, you know, on the various stakeholders in this problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're really focused on how, on the pharma side of our business, we're very focused on how companies can more effectively launch products into a payer-dominated marketplace. And it really starts, we think, with an objective, transparent understanding of the value of the asset. And that value has to be relative. It has to be compared to the other drugs in the competitive set. And what we do with our system is very transparently and objectively do that analysis from the point of view of efficacy, safety, ease of use, and the economics of the drugs from the point of view of the payer. That means we're able to show drug companies where their drugs are effective, where they don't have any advantages, and in which subpopulations they might have disproportionate value. That's part of the key issue. Now, I have been banging the drum around the notion of segmentation. Do drug companies understand which subpopulations they are most valuable in, and to which payer segments are they most attractive? Certainly, for example, in certain payer segments, new drugs are going to be much more challenging. I can think about, you know, a Medicare prescription drug plan, or PDP, where that plan has no responsibility for the overall cost of care. They're only focusing on the drug benefit and the cost of that drug benefit. They're going to be much more challenging when it comes to a new drug. And that means the drug companies who have drugs for that target those kinds of markets, the Medicare PDP market, for example, will have to come up with really smart development and commercialization programs to make sure that they're not blocked from those markets, that they don't have huge hurdles. And, you know, we saw, for example, with Novartis's heart failure drug Entresto, how specifically those kinds of plans can limit access, even though that drug, which is a great drug, does probably reduce overall cost and certainly improves health. How do you figure out the right payer segments are, what are the messages to the payer segments, or the populations, the patient populations that you're supposed to go to that will find the fewest, will encounter the fewest restrictions of these drugs? So that's a lot of what we do. We're also increasingly using our system, our technology, in other value assessment systems. The one we can talk about right now is our technology is the basis of the Sloan Kettering drug abacus system. And we're now working with a couple of other groups as well to have an assessment, where our assessment system, which is transparent, objective, technologically sophisticated, can in fact help these groups come practically to better decisions about in terms of evaluating drugs relative to each other.
Okay. And then on the payer side, I know you also work with payers. So What sorts of solutions do you bring to them?
Well, one of the advantages of what we do, of our system, is that we put all together in one place all of the information about a drug that you need to make a reasonable coverage policy decision. And for those payers who have a lot of drugs to worry about and to cover and figure out, we can provide a kind of one-stop shop for how they can make decisions in areas like dyslipidemia, for example, or multiple myeloma, or rheumatoid arthritis, where there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of data, and there are a lot of choices. So how do you quickly get through them? How do you understand them? And then how do you communicate the value of your choice or the rightness of your choice to your provider network? How do you then say to those providers, we've actually chosen drug X, which is a good value for our customers, our employer customers, for example, but it also is medically appropriate, and here's why. And they can show our system to their network and back up their choice.
Okay. Interesting. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today and your insights on this. It's a great, great topic and really appreciate it. So if our listeners would like to follow you or stay in touch with Real Endpoints, can you tell us how to do that?
I think the easiest way is our website, which is realendpoints.com.
Okay. Super. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy. Really appreciated the time.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining me today on Talk at the Top. Please take a moment to review the show on iTunes. Your feedback is very important to us. And be sure to visit our website, talkatthetop.com, and click on the Resources tab to access any books, links, or materials that were referenced on the show today.